Thinking Aloud from the University of Warwick.
Hello, welcome to another episode in our new favourite series of podcasts for the Early Modern Forum. My name is Jenny Bond. I am an MA History student at the University of Warwick. Joining me today is Professor Anthony McFarlane, Professor of Latin American History at the University of Warwick. Professor McFarlane's research focuses on the history of Colombia and Ecuador within the context of the Spanish colonial world between 1700 and 1850. His research interests also include the comparative history of late colonial Spanish America and British colonial history. His current research focuses on the Spanish-American Wars of Independence in the period 1810 to 1825. Professor McFarlane, thank you very much for joining me today to talk to us a little bit about your favourite primary and secondary sources. Can I start by asking you to tell us about your favourite primary sources?
Okay, yes, very difficult choice.
Sure.
Both favourite primary and favourite secondary sources pose lots of problems. I think, though, I'd want to start by talking about something that played quite an important part in my research at one stage of my life, which was a group of documents that I discovered, a long series of documents that I discovered in the National Archives in Bogota in Colombia. This was a group of documents bound in about 211 folios, bound allegedly by prisoners from the War of the Thousand Days into these folio collections. And the documents comprised something which had never been used by historians in Colombia before. They were called juicios criminales, which literally translated means criminal judgments. And this was a set of documents which were drawn from the judgments of the colonial high court, mostly for the 18th century. I was interested in them, and the reason I found them was because I was looking for documentation on rebellions. I was interested at that time in the history of rebellion in late colonial Spanish America. And in the course of looking for material on that in Colombia, I found this wonderful source. And it proved extraordinarily fruitful, and I would advise anybody, historian interested in social history, to look at criminal records. They're simply a wonderful source. Of course, that's quite well known now. In Spanish America, very little work had been done on criminal sources of this kind, and I found these juicios criminales to be a wonderful source of material for understanding local protests, local rebellions, and even the bigger rebellion that took place in Colombia in the late 18th century. But in addition to providing me with wonderful background and material for my work on rebellions, the other feature of this documentation is its extraordinary richness from the point of view of the social historian, because the crimes that went to this court included many things that we would not now regard as crimes. For example, people living in sin, what was called concubinage. There were wonderful descriptions of cases in which people were arraigned before the court for living illegally together. And what becomes apparent from reading these sources is it's not usually that people are regarded as behaving criminally, but rather that they've upset somebody else in the community who therefore decides to use the quirks of the law against them. But they also contain a wide range of intricate detail as people describe one another, they describe other people's moods and humours and habits, and indeed even in many cases their clothing. So one source that I'd like to single out because it was so useful to me and is such a rich source, I think, for the social history of a colonial society like Colombia, is this set of criminal judgments that are found in the Colombia National Archives. I then moved on to working in more recent years on the fall of Spain's empire and the Spanish-American Wars of Independence, as you mentioned in the introduction. And that, of course, is a huge field which offers many possibilities for talking about primary sources as well as secondary works. But rather than do that directly, I'd like to come at it tangentially and talk instead about another single source, because this is a single source which represents one good thing that can happen to historians. They can have a stroke of luck, find something in an archive when they're not actually looking for it. And secondly, because it points to an area of my own work in the history department, and to an area of the work of the School of Comparative American Studies in the history department. And it points to that because the document, as you'll see in a moment, engages what we would now regard as comparative analysis. So I'm going to talk about a memorandum that was written by a high-ranking Spanish army officer, a man with the rather French name of Duché, Francisco Duché, who wanted to inform the Spanish Minister of War of an imminent attack by the British on Mexico. Now, the document itself has quite an interesting history, because Duché had been sent on a military mission to Mexico to reform the Mexican army. This is a period of time after the Seven Years' War, when the crown is the Spanish crown is very concerned that the British are going to launch another attack on the Spanish possessions, particularly in North America. So Duché had been sent to help reorganize the Mexican army. On his way back to Spain after some years in Mexico, he was then shipwrecked off the coast of North America and spent 9 months in the hands of the British, mostly, it seems, with the British Army. And in that time, he came to certain conclusions about British belligerence and their ambitions in regard to Mexico. Now, that itself wasn't a particularly novel idea. Spanish Army officers and the Crown itself were, of course, acutely concerned with British expansion and British ambitions in the Americas. But the great thing about Duché's memo is that it had some really unusual features. First of all, he acquired all this information that he relayed to the Minister of War. He acquired it firsthand. He talked to British Army officers, he watched British parades, he watched army manoeuvres. The British officers, it seems, treated him as an equal, and he was invited to have dinner with them, and he refers to the fact that often when they were getting a bit drunk towards the end of the evening, they would talk about their plans to invade Mexico. So he felt that he was getting this from the horse's mouth, so to speak. But that's really not the most striking thing about the document. Perhaps the most striking thing about it is that he offered, first of all, a rather unconventional appraisal of the form that the British threat would take. He, like most military men, believed that the traditional belief was that Mexico had to be defended against an amphibious assault. That was the way the British usually, and not surprisingly, attacked Spanish colonies. They'd done it against Havana very successfully in 1762, and Veracruz, the port of Mexico, was seen as the next potential target. Duché believed that was wrong. He believed that what he'd learned from these British officers was that the British were going to attack overland using soldiers recruited from amongst the colonial population in North America, and they were going to come in via Texas. So that was one unconventional thing that he drew attention to. The more novel feature of his analysis was the kind of mode of analysis that he adopted. Rather than just focusing, as most army officers did, on the organizational deficiencies of the army — he did have something to say about that, he thought the Mexican army was a mess, basically — but rather than focus on that, he offered an analysis of New Spain's defense, New Spain being Mexico mostly. He offered an analysis of that defence which related defence to the social structure of the country. What he did was to embrace the modern assumption that states have to rely on their citizens in time of war to fight for them. And he then went on to raise pretty fundamental questions about the ability of the Spanish state to mobilise the colonial population in Mexico in time of war. He argued that it couldn't, that there was a great danger here, because New Spain wasn't just a colony, but it was a colony of a particular kind. He thought that the ethnic composition of Mexico's people, the backwardness of the Mexican economy, and the outmoded character of its government were all great weaknesses which exposed it to British attack. And he did this, he drove home this point about Mexican weaknesses by making, very unusually, a direct and quite detailed comparison between social conditions, social and political conditions in Mexico with those in British North America. He told the Minister of War that the British colonies of North America, were a kind of model society. He said that its provinces were well governed, they had a very productive agriculture, they made ample use of their land, they had cities that were almost as beautiful as those in Europe, they had numerous people whom he described as all white, all robust, all clean, without the poverty or what he called the indiada, the Indian peasantry of Mexico. And he goes on to use this linkage of poverty, weakness and impurity to cast the rest of his analysis with a rather racist tone. As far as he was concerned, the success of the British colonies and their military strength derived from the European character of the population. Indeed, he went further. He not only admired British policy of allowing European immigrants into the colony, something which Spain, of course, didn't do. It restricted movement from Spain alone. But he also went much further and applauded the British colonists' destruction, active destruction of Native American cultures, by what he called the ingenious method of addicting the Indians to rum and gin. This, he said, pushed the Indians back into the interior, where they died, I quote, happy to be drunk. And this left their lands free to be appropriated by European settlers. So what he does is present the British colonies as a kind of prosperous, progressive, neo-European society, which for those reasons was a much stronger base for imperial defence and for imperial expansion than anything that Mexico could offer to the Spanish monarchy. His line was that the great strength of British America was, again I quote, a free people who breathe contentment, in sharp contrast to Mexico, which he described as a land of taxes and a land oppressed, whose people were of doubtful loyalty. Well, in the event, like other predictions that we've had in more recent years about situations inside countries, he turned out to be wrong. His prediction of an imminent British attack turned out to be completely mistaken, because within 3 years of him writing that document, Britain was at war with its own colonists. These free people who breathed contentment turned against Britain in the American Revolution. But it seems to me the analysis is still interesting, because it does recognise in a very overt way a fundamental problem for Spanish policy in the 18th century, which was, could Spain build its defences on a civilian population which was deeply divided by race, culture and class? Could the empire remain stable on the basis upon which it had traditionally been built? Well, that raises questions which I'm going to take up then in talking about my favourite secondary source. I don't want to preempt your question.
No, please do.
But this kind of flows into talking a little about the secondary sources. I mean, given that the document I've just described raises rather interesting comparative questions as they were formulated by an educated 18th century observer, so I want to move on to a book which also addresses comparative issues from the perspective of a contemporary historian of our times. I choose John Eliot's wonderful book, Empires of the Atlantic World, and I choose it because it offers a very full and fascinating comparison of the Spanish and British empires in America from the time of Columbus's discovery in 1492 to the early 19th century, the 1830s, when the Spanish Empire is finally pretty much replaced, completely replaced by independent republics. This is a big book, and it's difficult to do justice to such a large book, which blends the big picture, indeed several big pictures, with a great deal of telling detail. So I'm not going to attempt to do much more than draw attention to its virtues and try to encourage people to read it. In the first place, it's based on a narrative which is in itself quite gripping. Historians sometimes reject the chronological approach, but in this work of John Eliot's, it provides a vital framework for comparative analysis, as well as for informing the reader and engaging the reader's attention. What Eliot does is to take the reader through all the key themes for anyone who is interested in understanding how early modern European societies created empires overseas, and how and why those empires differed. So what he does is to trace the similarities and differences in at various levels. First of all, patterns of settlement, forms of settlement, types of conquest. Secondly, the attitudes of Europeans from different European societies towards the native peoples that they encountered. Thirdly, he looks at another great theme for early modern history, that of the role of religion in shaping social and political action. And he also looks at the ways in which these colonies interact with the social, political, economic orders which they bring from Europe, and also how they interact amongst themselves. And in particular, he's interested in trying to draw attention to the parallels between development in Spanish America and British America, and the awareness that contemporary observers had of those semblances and differences. So what he takes us through is a very kaleidoscopic picture of the development of these two kinds of early modern imperialism, one springing from Castile in the Spanish and the Iberian Peninsula, and the other springing from England. Each, of course, starting at different dates, but one, in a sense, leading on from the other. Well, we learn, of course, first of all, that Castile and England both have some colonising experience. They have one thing in common, which is some colonising experience before they get to the Americas. Both of them had been engaged in frontier warfare within, on the borders of their own territory, going back into the Middle Ages, the Spaniards against the Moors, as they were called, against the various Islamic kingdoms and princedoms within the Iberian Peninsula, and the English against the Welsh and the Scots, and of course increasingly in the 16th century against the Irish. He also points out to us that the ideas which these people have, both in England and in Spain, about how to subordinate and exploit native peoples of other areas were quite similar. I mean, it's been common to draw a distinction between the Spanish as people imbued with Catholicism and a certain kind of feudal tradition, as against the English Protestants coming from a different kind of society in the 17th century. But in reality, if one looks at 16th century English adventures in the Americas, something which I've written about myself, you find that there is an attempt to imitate the Spanish. And the Spanish are regarded very much as the model. So the English do not start their imperialism with an idea that they're going to do something that's entirely different from and superior to the Spanish. They are, in fact, in the 16th century, pretty eager to imitate them. We also see, however, how the different environments into which 16th century Spaniards and 17th century English people move, how that impinges on the ways in which their societies develop. In Mexico and Peru, to take the two obvious examples, the Spaniards found sophisticated societies, dense populations living from very productive, highly organized agriculture. And they also, of course, found precious metals in both those areas, gold and, in massive quantities, silver, it was later to transpire. The English, by contrast, entered lands in the Americas which the Spaniards had pretty much ignored because they didn't think they were worth much. Neither New England nor Virginia, the two first areas that are colonised by the English, had gold or silver, nor did they have the dense indigenous populations that would provide foundations for settlement and a means to enrich the English monarchy. The settlers, though, of course, were also very different. Those who went to New England were people who were concerned primarily with their own spiritual world, with their salvation. They weren't intent on creating religious utopias outside of the persecution of the old world, and they paid pretty little attention to the Indians. The Spaniards, on the other hand, from the very beginning, are absorbed and to some degree obsessed by the idea of converting Indians to Christianity. They see that as a primary task, and they wanted not to keep the Indians away, but to integrate the Indians into their own hierarchical social order. Spaniards were also much more disposed to miscegenate, to mix with Indian women, and to start a racially blended population. Indeed, in most of Spain's colonies, that racially blended population is eventually to become the majority. By the 18th century, most of the colonies have majorities that are composed of what were called mestizos, people of mixed race. Sexual mixing is also matched by cultural blending. Indian beliefs were incorporated into Christianity, sometimes reluctantly, but certainly incorporated, and Indian crafts and Indian skills were worked into Spanish material culture. That's most obviously seen in the very large numbers of churches that were built in the colonial period. Religion is all important to the Spanish colonial order. You don't find fortresses in Spanish America, you find churches dominating the landscapes. In British America, by contrast, there is also a varied religious life, but it's confined to white society. In British America, there is an extraordinary religious pluralism, the spectrum of Protestant sects brought from Europe that compete with the Anglican Church, but it doesn't extend into the indigenous population, nor, during most of the colonial period, does it extend to the black slave population that's created by the plantations in British North America. Well, those are just some of Eliot's comparisons. I mean, I've got no more time really to to do much more than urge the listener to read to find the book and read it.
Yeah, it sounds fantastic. Both your primary and secondary sources sound like really unique sources for comparative cultural analysis. Especially your primary source sounds like a really rich, fascinating read. So I'm sure any listeners who are interested in those topics would now know where to go for further information on what you've highlighted for us. So yes, well, thank you very much for joining me today, and thank you for listening to another episode of our favourite series.
Thank you.
Thinking Aloud from the University of Warwick.